for the first Christmas after 9/11, was just 2 months away, and that first child sitting on my lap, and me saying, "Merry Christmas." Yeah. The child looking at me and saying, "My daddy died when the towers fell. And how do you recover or respond in the moment?"
Right.
And for me, it was, "I'm so sorry to hear that. Can I tell you a secret?" And the little boy said, "Sure." And I said, "I knew your daddy." And the little boy said, "You knew my daddy?" I said, "Yeah, I used to bring him presents when he was your age. And I'll tell you another secret. He was always on the good boy list, just like you are this year. So I need to know what you want for Christmas this year."
Right.
And the person standing next to me twisting candy cane balloons was like, "He's really Santa Claus."
Yeah.
But I was just meeting the kid where he was.
Right.
And,
right.
It, you know, it was a tragic thing. What would Santa say?
Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton, and this is my first ever episode of this podcast. It's the pilot episode. And rather than explain what this podcast is about, I'm just going to jump right in and talk about today's theme. The theme is career and what it's like to have a career as an artist, any type of artist. In this context, living in New York City, what it's like trying to be an artist in this city, paying rent and trying to avoid starvation. With me today is the magical, wonderful Glenn Heroy. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Very nice adjectives. Thank you so much.
Glenn is a prolific clown. He was a clown at Big Apple Circus. He appeared on the PBS series Circus. You could see him on the cover and on all the posters. He is also a very busy Santa, was very busy last month. He was a Santa at Macy's. He was a Santa with the Hess company. He's also a very diverse, versatile impersonator.
Yes, this is true.
Ozzy Osbourne, Elton John, Dame Edna. One time, the Queen Elizabeth Windsor. And today we're talking about career. So Glenn, you've had a long-standing career now. How many? It's been decades.
Yeah, I came to New York in 1981. I was a teenager, and have been performing ever since. Started doing children's theater, where they would pay me $25 a show and all the free hot dogs I could eat. Done a myriad of survival jobs just to pay the rent. My first rent in New York was as an illegal sublet in Hell's Kitchen, and my buddy from college and I split the rent, which I believe was $60 a piece. And we had a hard time coming up with that back in 1980, and especially when I was only making $25 a show. It was wild because I didn't understand networking. I didn't understand sustainability of a career. I was just kind of going off what gave me joy.
Mm-hmm.
And someone 10 years later said, "It's the journey that matters." Scratch my head and say, "What does that mean?" And I realized that's what I've been doing the whole time. It's going from show to company to survival job, because you really wanted to follow a dream or an idea of a dream.
And then what happened as far as the career element of business, or, you know, how to pay the $60 rent in Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah, it was that.
Did you pick that up along the way?
The business part of show business was harder for me, of course. Suffering my own demons and not being completely organized is one of them. Suffering from depression is another one. Having a nervous breakdown when I was 21 was another stumbling block.
At one point, you were homeless, too.
I was. I was homeless in the 80s for about 6 months, and they were six winter months. Oh. So that was an exciting time in New York. It was right around the time that crack was hitting the streets of New York, and it was a strange rough and tumble time. But through all that, I played Santa Claus. I did children's theater. I had things to elevate me and keep me buoyant. I don't like asking for help. I've never liked asking for help. I know now I could have gone to some people and said, can you help me out with this? I've got nowhere to stay. And and I did from time to time. I'd find an old college buddy and say, can I stay on your couch? And didn't want to overstay my welcome, and I'd leave the next day. But I was not good about... I was so fucking egotistical that I thought I didn't need to ask for help. I can do this myself. And I'd been mugged 3 times living in Hell's Kitchen. I just... opportunities had fallen through my fingers, and I was just so... so leery of anybody being nice or trying to help.
Right. That's a hard lesson.
It really kind of is. You know, you find yourself in the middle of old Times Square with an old Foot Locker with everything you own in it. And I remember propping it up on its end and kind of leaning back on it and looking up and not being able to see stars because I was in the center of Times Square, but just seeing a ton of neon. And there were porn houses and there were arcades, and it was a rough, different Times Square. And just thinking, what next? You know, it was that kind of a feeling.
What was the first thing you did in New York?
As a performer?
Yes.
Joined a theater company that was a children's theater company based out of Queens. And they just threw me right into the fold. They couldn't understand why a 6-foot, kind of lanky guy with a lot of hair, they were looking for somebody to play Robin Hood. And they couldn't find a leading man, and they wound up with me, this goofy-looking character actor, and I just clowned my way through that part and stayed with that company for a few years. And
what was it like for the kids?
They had a ball.
Yeah,
it was just too much fun. I had a ball. They had a ball. It was a lot of fun.
You have to understand, Glenn. Sort of his personality changes when he starts performing for children, as opposed to the context of performing for adults. And when you see a child audience member, I've seen it in you when I've watched you perform, either as a clown or any sort of character, a Santa, it's sort of like a different persona.
Yeah, it is transformative in a way, and yet physically I can bulk up and look very scary. I can shave my head and wear big earrings and work out and pump up my arms and look scary. I was working in China in Shanghai, and I was playing a character that was that. This big, hulking, kind of bald man who was a chain smoker with painted nails and one black eye and would be blaring AC/DC music. And I'd be lumbering with this trunk on my back, and my partner was spry and young and had Heelys on and was making circles around me, and I was this plodding kind of locomotive, and I looked really mean and horrible and nasty, and people were handing me their infant children to take a picture. It's like, oh, look, take a picture. And for some reason, kids see through all that. One little kid said, I really like him. He looks like mean, but he's not.
It's like Frankenstein in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's this
archetype of the gentle giant.
Yeah, and it works out well, and kids do get drawn to me. I never, ever talk down to children. I never do. I don't do it when I'm Santa Claus. I don't do it when I'm a clown. I speak the truth to them. When I say, oh, can I just have one kernel of popcorn? Just throw it right here at my tongue. Just throw it right here. And they miss. I go, my tongue! Not over there. What's wrong? Oh, come on. Try it again. And it becomes play. I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen and go, oh, thanks for the popcorn, because that is just so false.
So you relate to them as yourself, as truthfully as possible, and it's not overwhelming, it's not scary?
In my estimation, that is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I can, as a clown or as Santa Claus, been doing Santa Claus for 34 years. been performing as Santa Claus for 34 years. That's a better sentence. I was doing Santa at Macy's, doing some outreach work for them outside of the store. Often people are afraid of Santa Claus. Little children are afraid of Santa Claus. Little adults are afraid of Santa Claus.
Clowns, too.
Yeah, the actual phobia of coulrophobia. It's a real fear. Yes, I had a connection to the children who would come. If the parents would just chill out, I could get very scared children to calm down and not cry and be in a picture. I would do this outreach work to shelters, to step-up homes where the moms were off the street with their children. I had a huge connection. And then one day I was doing an event as Santa Claus up at the George Washington Bridge bus terminal. Do you know there is one?
Yes.
I did not know that until I was a Santa there in some utility room, and they were busing in for 2 days, 500 children a day.
Wow.
Inner city, no money.
Right up to the terminal?
They would come into the
terminal. In the 170s?
Yeah. And then they would get out, and they would come and visit with me. I don't know where these kids were coming from. There would be 500 at a time.
Wow.
And it was for 3 hours. So I'd knock out 500 kids in 3 hours. And there was a scheduling snafu once, and 1,000 kids showed up on the first day.
Whoa. You said 1,000 within
3 hours.
I don't know anyone mentally equipped to handle being Santa for 1,000 children. In the span of 3 hours.
Well, it was, in ways, there were some beautiful and magical things happening. They all got a Polaroid with Santa.
1,000 Polaroids.
Yeah. And there was a stack of film, and there was a police officer who was a transit cop. And I remember him, the photographer had to leave after 3 hours, and we still didn't see all the kids. And this cop just turned his hat around backwards and kneeled down and started taking pictures of the kids. There was a magician and his wife, and they kept doing magic. And all the kids had name tags on, which is just incredible.
Yeah.
Because I can say, oh my gosh, it's Julian, how are you? And they'll freak out. Yeah. Oh, it's really Santa, not realizing that their name is on their chest. And it's just, there were so many magical things to be drawn from that.
That sounds like a Guinness World Record.
I don't know. I do. The most I averaged at any event or being at Macy's was 4 children a minute.
4 children.
Yeah, so 15 seconds for each visit with Santa to make them really feel like they visited with me.
Right.
And it's, you get in a rhythm and you look them in the eye and you just say, it's so good to see you.
Right.
And I know you've been good all year.
But to have that much intensity within 15 seconds.
Yeah.
To get that high turnover,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's a high.
Wow.
It really is. You go home in ice after, but it's it really is a high. So at this 1,000 child debacle that really had some magical moments in it, there were some children in wheelchairs and that were off to the side, and one of their handlers came over and said, is it all right if these children come over? And I was thinking, they should be in the front of the line, there's no reason they should wait. But they came up at the end when it got a little quiet, which I guess was good for some of them, and I met with some special needs children, and then there was this one boy who was a gangly boy that they lifted up out of a wheelchair. He was this gorgeous black kid. He was gorgeous. And he was smiling and laughing. And he had cerebral palsy. And they put him on my lap. And then they got this this big yellow keyboard thing that looked like the old Pong Atari. It was that big. And he took his little gnarled finger and he pointed and he hit one button, and out of this unit it said, I love you, Santa. And he was rolling his head and laughing, and I was hugging him and kissing his head and saying, Santa loves you too, it's so good to see you, you're such a good boy. And it was just this wonderful moment. And I looked, and all of the handlers were either frozen or crying. And when they came to put him back in his wheelchair, they said, he doesn't communicate with anybody. And all day it took him to program that into his little speaking device. Mm-hmm. And he was, for some reason, the beard broke it down. It was a beard and a red suit, and
right.
It just became this moment that was transformative for me and also for that kid. And it said to me, I want to find a job that I can do all year long. I can get a paycheck, mm-hmm. and I could be helping children who are not in the best circumstances. I then shot a commercial for Nobody Beats the Whiz. Do you remember that song?
Yeah.
Nobody Beats the Whiz.
They had one near City Hall.
Yes, they were all over. And it was this song they used this ran during the Christmas season. Jingle, jangle. Well, it's Christmas time once again. Mm-hmm. And we were the employees of this Nobody Beats the Whiz. And we shot it through the night, got rid of the real employees. Mm-hmm. And we came in and made more money. And this thing was a buyout, and it just ran like crazy. One of the guys in the commercial worked for the Big Apple Circus Clown Care Unit. And in fact, the choreographer did too. I thought, well, maybe this is the place for me to revamp my clowning. That's when I signed up to take classes with David Shiner and to get polish up my clowniness. And and then I was doing a lot of corporate entertaining, impersonating people to pay the bills. And during the time of Austin Powers, where everybody was playing Austin Powers, I decided to shave my head and play Dr. Evil. So I booked a lot just because...
Was that your first celebrity impersonator gig?
No, first one was by accident, and it was Elton John.
Oh, okay.
And it was, at some gig, and they wanted me to play a fake paparazzi person, mm-hmm. and take a lot of flashy pictures for the impersonator. Yeah, the De Niro and the Joe Pesci and the Bette Midler, who's a great friend of mine, and the Tina Turner, who was a woman in blackface. I mean, it was wild. It was a different time. So they say, can you come in some garish outfit so you stand out from the crowd? I said, sure. They said, oh, the name of the place is Redheads. Can you, like, throw a red wig on? I said, sure. I threw this red wig on. It was right at the time that Elton had his straight red hair. The glasses I wear are similar to his. And when I walked in, I had a gap in my teeth, which was natural.
Hmm.
And everybody thought I was Elton. And I had my ear pierced. They were like, oh, my God, you're Elton John. And randomly, a bunch of agents were there. And the agent that hired me was there and said, tell them you're Elton John, tell them you're Elton John. So I said, I'm Elton John, everybody. And they applauded. And they had a karaoke machine up there. And then they said, can you sing? And I'm like, sure. And they put on Crocodile Rock. And I was standing in between Bette Midler and Tina Turner. And I just started singing Crocodile Rock. And they're like, he can sing. Out come the business cards. Next thing you know, I'm at Joe Allen's, hanging out with Frank Gorshin. It was just a surreal evening, mm-hmm. that, again, just changed my life, and I was doing Elton John from there. But here I am playing Dr. Evil at some trade show 10 years later, and there was a little person playing Mini-Me,
mm-hmm.
and I was chasing him around going, come here, you little bastard. Yeah. So I put a bell on him, and I was like running around chasing this little person as Dr. Evil. And some people from the Big Apple Circus Clown Care Unit happened to be there, and they said, come and audition. And that's how I got the audition. And that's how I got involved with being a clown that works in hospitals.
Right.
Which, in my estimation, defined who I was.
Hi, everybody. If you're a starving artist like me, you don't work for exposure. If you'd like to show your support financially for this podcast, please go to GoFundMe.com and donate to the Neo Bohemia podcast campaign. Search NEO-BOHEMIA podcast or follow the link provided in this podcast. No donation is too small or too large. Thank you for your generosity, and now back to our program.
And when he's really enjoying something, he's really enjoying it. So I think that, oh, look, a gunshot, Charlie.
Yeah, a gunshot.
Outside the window. Wow.
Welcome to Harlem.
Welcome back. Glenn, we were talking about clown care.
For how long did you do that?
I did that for 8 years. I'd spend, for the Big Apple Circus Clown Care Unit, I spent 6 summers, did 16 sessions, which were week-long sessions, over 6 years for Paul Newman's Hole in the Wall Gang Camp as a clown in residence, where you clown as verb from 8:30 in the morning till 11:30 at night, and it is just, it's a draconian pace that just it's so fulfilling, because when you are working in the hospitals, you're treating the part of the child that's well. That's how they said it in the Big Apple Circus.
That job could potentially be one of the saddest, most depressing types of environments if you don't focus on the
on what's healthy of the child.
Right.
That's right. And then to see them, children in remission, running around in a camp, archery and wood shop, and I mean, things you would not have a child with HIV around in the real world, they would encourage up there. And it was beautiful. I'd work sessions where they'd bring in 125 children that all had sickle cell, and they would raise the temperature of the pool, and they would do all the precautions and bring in a whole medical staff that knows this. And then the next week, out they would go, and in would come children who were all infected with HIV, and have 125 of them. And it was just amazing to watch these people do what they do up there, many of them being volunteers. And the, in my estimation, most prestigious, most coveted, most fun job was the one, the only one I could do, which was be a clown there. I could not run the boathouse. I could not teach boating and fishing. I couldn't be out at the campground.
But it's perfectly suited to your personality, the way that you relate to children.
Yeah.
Not talking down to them. And now this added challenge of how do you approach a child with special needs or terminal illness?
Yeah. Oh, that first session ended with me in tears in a fetal position, crying in the clown office, just because it was so moving. They end with a big slideshow of that week, and there's this one girl with her shaved head who had cancer, and she had never been there before. I don't think she ever came after, because she was aged out. And she just was the rock star of that week. And it was like nothing was wrong. And seeing her strength and command, and she was an alpha cat, boy. She's just, everybody wanted to be around her. And she was throwing a frisbee in this one picture. And I had been working these very long days with a partner I'd just done, never really worked with before, especially in those intense circumstances. And I just lost it. I don't know what it was. And I had to be shuffled out of that auditorium where they were showing that slideshow, brought downstairs into this clown office in the basement, and just cried and wept. And some other people who came there and had done clown care, where one kneeled to help, the other one was saying, "Let him cry! This is for all the kids who were at Sloan Kettering. He's crying for all of them." The camp director came by like, "What is going on?" And it was legendary how much I broke down after that. And yeah, it was very moving and very emotional. And then, you know, you see Paul Newman go by on a bicycle. And you're like, It's a great day.
Yeah. It seems like a strange challenge, because if you say you deal with depression,
yeah,
and then you you also appeal to the positivity, the best part, the wellness of a child as a clown. There's still the element, the best part of your performance with a kid is how well you relate to them as yourself truthfully.
Yes.
And yet you're still, through your depression, through all of these challenges that you see in them looking at you, you can still appeal to the goodness and the happiness and the wellness and the joy and the funny and the clown parts.
Well, one thing that that camp director said to me as I was blubbering and inconsolable was, you have to know how deep down sad you can go in order to get as high and happy as you need to be. You need that balance. And I, at the time, I was just yelling, shut up, leave me alone! But as I thought about it more in life, you know, that kind of served me well to know that, yeah, I can suffer from depression, and I can check that at the door when I'm around kids in the hospital. That's a thing when I teach is check your ego at the door. You walk into that kid's room, it's not about you, it's about the kid. And the kid is running the visit. I used to work with a very rigid, lovely man who thought very linearly, is that the correct word?
Linearly?
Yeah.
Straightforward?
Yes, and so we were doing a thing with those little delight things that light up in your hand, and you can throw them and catch them, and then it looks like it's going through your body, and it looks like this magical light, because often the children have a clamp on their finger, and it lights the same color, and that goes to some kind of beeping monitor, and we would grab that light from them and we'd play catch with it. And if I went and threw it in the bathroom and shut the door and the little child in the bed said, it's in the closet, my partner would say, no, it's in the bathroom. But I would say, it's in the closet. So I'd walk over and open it up. Hey, it was in the closet.
Right.
And so it's that type of thing where it is really not about you. If the kid says, flush that light down the toilet, I would pretend throw it in the toilet and flush it down. And it would again pop out of the most embarrassing place on their parent that I could pull it out of.
This reminds me of one of the most important lessons I've ever learned from just working alongside you, Glenn. Clown logic.
Yeah.
You teach clowning, you're still clowning. And I never thought of this concept until I experienced it firsthand from you, just explaining bits. Clown logic it's an explanation of how to write a bit, or it's how to perform in a way that defies the creative barriers that many people face when they're trying to sketch something.
Yeah.
And I love that idea of clown logic.
Yeah, there's so much brought to the table with that, because you've got to understand status. You've got to understand motivation. You have to understand the structure of 1, 2, 3. And it all gets woven into a way of looking at stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you can't, just don't, you know, you can't play that in here.
Right. Yeah. That's, and I think for many performers, the whatever type of realism or whatever artistic, aesthetic barriers that they've set for themselves, saying, this can't be this way.
Yeah.
If you could translate that into the same scenario you face when a kid says, it's not in the bathroom, it's in the closet.
Yeah.
You got to make that happen.
Right.
That seems to me what clown logic perfectly illustrates.
And it's total listening. It's, you sacrifice any bit in the world to go with what the kid says.
Right.
And many clown performers would come in and know that I can juggle these four rings, and then I can switch the sides and the rings are changing color. And then I start flipping them in the air and all four land on my head and go down on my neck like a necklace. Ta-da, I'm done. But if that you start juggling and the kid goes, don't juggle in here, you drop it.
Right.
But I'd work with people who will just, wait, look, they're going to change color. And it's like, stop juggling. wait, look what I can do. 1, 2, 3, 4, they're on my head. And it's that type of thing where...
You can't be in denial of what is. And for circus, for clowning, for children, right. Obviously,
yeah.
There's such an immediate response time.
Yeah, I would...
They'll let you know.
Oh, my God, yeah. People would send me pictures of myself, because I wouldn't Google my own name and look for them. People would send me pictures of me performing in the tent, and I would never look at myself, but I'd always look at the audience. And if they're smiling and laughing in the audience and they're engaged, I knew I was doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
There was I would have to get children to come out to do this one bit in the ring, and often... You know, kids would raise their hand, take me. You go to take them, then they don't want to go. And there was this one boy in the front row who just was like, I am not going. And he was maybe 10 or 11, and I'm like, come on, let's go in the ring. And I grabbed his foot, and I started dragging him, like, over the thing. And his parents are laughing, and he's laughing, and he's holding on. And I pull his shoe off.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a shoe in my hand, and I just threw it in the middle of the ring. And I went, fetch! And he wouldn't go. This kid was not coming into the ring, and he was laughing.
Right.
And I did the, okay, we're friends, it's no problem. I went and got a shoe.
Right.
I just threw it out of the ring on the complete other side.
Right, so the newly formed obstacle is the story.
Yes, but in a way, the more obstacles they throw at you, the more opportunities you have.
Right.
And it that became very exciting. Many, many clowns that I work with, including David Shiner. God, he's amazing. He will be in the audience while the audience is taking their seats.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll wear a trench coat and a hat and not look like David Shiner. So look like a guy walking into a seat. And meanwhile, he is just scanning the audience for volunteers. To hand pick the right ones to make his bit fly, and I've never seen his bit not fly. And that's a perfect. I'm sure there's times where it didn't work as well, but I was never in the audience for them, and his way of choosing it was just, it's exact, it's surgical. And for me, I would start my bit by running around the ring, and waving to everybody. And just make one big circle while the music was playing. So everybody could see me and who I was and what I looked like. And the joy I was having for being there. But in that instant, in a Malcolm Gladwell blink moment, I would say, that kid. That's the kid that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've failed. And I brought in, it was a Lita band, and they had a conduct with their finger.
Mm-hmm.
And I would bring kids in that were missing a hand.
Mm-hmm.
I brought an autistic kid in, and the parents were like, we have no idea how this is going to go. And I said, okay, well, let's see, under my breath, and brought that kid out, and that kid knocked it out of the park. Because I said, when I go like this, you start conducting. And the kid looked at me and said, when you go like this, I start conducting. And laughed. And I said, okay, the band's going to play. And the kid would go, the band's going to play. And the band played. He just started conducting. And it was amazing. It was just amazing. I failed in choosing people, like being in China and having the language gap. And I once chose a blind guy. Which was really kind of stupid, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
in the context of what we're doing, performing in China outdoors. But yeah, it's such an immediate kind of, it's that kid. It's going to be that kid. And
right.
You just know it. If that kid doesn't want to come in, then another bit is born.
Right.
And you play what's in front of you. And that's clown logic in a way, is... That you know, that kid doesn't want to come. I'm throwing that kid under my arm and carrying him in. And God, I used to love doing that. And kids are really bendy. They're funny. You can move them around
right.
and stuff. And,
what was the hardest you've ever bombed as a clown?
Oh, my God. Doing the Big Apple Circus, being in a Big Top for the first time, doing a bit I hadn't written, but I inherited.
Mm-hmm.
And needing audience members and not being able to rehearse it.
Circumstances,
yeah,
logistics.
Because you're up in a place and you're rehearsing a circus and there's no audience. So you use the kids on the lot the first five times and then they know the bit better than you and they start sabotaging you. And so I'd gone out and just completely bombed. I also doing stuff with a partner that worked in China, outdoors, bringing it indoors, mm-hmm. and doing it in New York and having it just fall flat, mm-hmm. and having the lighting guy cut the lights in the middle of it, just because
brutal
it wasn't working. Yeah, I've gone down in flames more times than I care to admit, but it's the type of thing where you just have to do it,
right?
You know.
So you were working as Santa, you were doing celebrity impersonations, you were a clown. Mm. For Big Apple Circus.
Mm-hmm.
And then also at which hospital?
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Mm-hmm. And that was a long stretch.
Yeah.
I learned on my feet being a hospital clown.
8 years.
Uh-huh.
How did you finish the 8 years?
I finished strong. In marathon running terms, I, you know, paced myself as best I could.
What is the average career of a Sloan Kettering Cancer Center clown?
For Big Apple Circus, they had a lot of different hospitals in the program. Mm-hmm. When I joined in 2000, I think they had 9 hospitals in New York and another, I don't know, 5-6 across the country, sister programs in Brazil and in France. Mm-hmm. And but when it was time for me to settle in and find a hospital that I felt the most comfortable in and start being a supervisor, I really chose Sloan Kettering. I heard everything everybody had to say about it. You'll burn out there. It's the hardest place to work because the mortality rate is so high. You get attached to the families, and then they, you know, when the child dies, you lose the child and the whole family, and it's a tough place to work. You'll burn out. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to burn out, I want to burn out in the hardest place to work. I want to do the best work that I can. I want to... there are clowns who do clown care who have been doing it 15, 20 years, uh-huh. who are doing the same 3 jokes, 2 songs on the ukulele, and same 4 juggling patterns. And I didn't want to become that clown. I wanted every day to be new. I wanted to find new material. I wanted to have nothing be precious. I wanted to burn it. I wanted to go in there and every day have a fire lit under my ass. Because it was a long-term facility, and I sometimes would see kids 2-3 times a week for 11, 12 months and get to know their families and get to know the rhythms of what their kids liked. And it was the type of thing where people can make things a little too precious. Mm-hmm. And I want to be that part of the kids' playfulness where it's ridiculous, and I would go into a kid's room and say, "Oh, you get to lay down all day. I gotta work. Move over, move over." And I would try to get in the bed. I'd be like, "Move over, give me some of that pillow." They'd be like, "Stop it, stop it." My partner would be pulling me out. "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm tired. We've been working for at least an hour. This is brutal." And if you acted like they weren't in a hospital or they didn't have an IV, I was playing it real, and you can burn out from doing that. But for me, it was losing a child. It was, you get very close to these children, and there were some that passed away, and their parents would invite me to their funerals, and I would go and be a mess. Mm-hmm. And I had to stop going to children's funerals. I've heard of other clowns being asked to go dressed as their clown persona from the hospital because that's how the child knew them. But I never felt that to be appropriate because, again, it's not about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the child. It's about the family, and I want to pay it respect. But I had shown up at 2-3 funerals, and the parents are up by his little tiny coffin, and they're greeting people as they come by, and they're keeping it together, and they're stoic as they can be, and they see me, and they fucking lose it, and they start to cry, and one woman collapsed, and as they went to pick her up, people were looking at me like, who is this asshole?
Right.
And she said, no, you don't understand. You don't understand what this man did. You don't understand what he's done for my family. And it's because when they see me, they see their child alive and laughing.
Right.
And they're with a little open casket. It's brutal for them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had one little girl that I got very attached to because I got so attached to her whole family, and I had met them outside, I'd run into them at the zoo because I'd overhear them say, hey, we're going to the zoo after. So I would show up as me at the zoo and go, what are you doing here? And they would, I'd buy a thing of popcorn, and as they rode the carousel, every time the little girl went by, I'd act like I was startled, and the popcorn would go all over, and she'd laugh, and I'd be like, quiet, and put the popcorn back, and you know, you get to know these little kids, and some of them really attached to you, and when this one little girl passed away, I was so broken, because she was like a little goofball, and we had so much fun together, and I was like, I can't. I'd lost many children that were very dear to me, and I'm still in contact with their parents, and they still write to me. I have relationships now with 16-year-old children who were little kids when I met them, mm-hmm. and they kicked their cancer.
Wow.
And now I go to their graduations, and their sweet 16s, and their... I'm a player in their life who they thank. This one little girl went on Instagram and had a picture of me and said, I want to thank, you know, first she thanked God, and then she thanked me for being there for her and helping her get through what she had to get through,
yeah.
and making her laugh. And she still texts me today. She has a countdown down to her graduation. And so it's amazing, and I still get, I'll still call certain families on, mm-hmm. on holidays as if I'm part of their family. I write emails to certain families on the anniversary of their child's birth, and they'll in turn find pictures of me and their children and send them to me still. And I left that hospital in 2008. So I know I've done some good and some profound work. In my lowest times, I always say I've done nothing with my life because I want to do so much more. And I have to be reminded that there are people who think about you every day because of what you've done for them. And it's a nice feeling at the end of the day to lock your door and lay in bed and think, yeah, okay, I did some nice stuff and it worked. And yeah, I've bombed in the hospital. I've done some stupid stuff.
Mm.
I've also used incredible clown logic in the hospital.
Did you refine your artistry as a clown?
Absolutely. When I told certain event planners and corporate party bookers that I would be doing Elton John and The Grinch for, they said, you know, if you join this clown care unit, the children are just going to be so appreciative that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even have to push yourself. And they just didn't get it.
Right.
And so your art is going to suffer because you're going to be, you know, you just show up and, oh, they're happy.
Do the same jokes.
Yeah. And they didn't realize that
Whereas if your heart's in it, the stakes couldn't be any higher.
Right. And I was flexing muscles I didn't know I had. I mention a story sometimes, and I found out that it was brought up just recently at some clown meeting through another person about going into a room and seeing that a child was new and he was about 14 and the family was around him and he's in bed. And I just said, oh, a new person. Great. I turned to my partner. Let's get that orientation packet. And then he just like gives me some piece of paper. And I'm like, let's read off these questions. I'm sorry they make us do this. And so we asked just the most idiotic questions. You know, are you married or happy? You know, Ginger or Marianne? And like the parents are laughing and the kid doesn't even know what we're talking about. And,
right.
You know, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
Right.
And they answer these stupid questions. And then we get to, do you have holes in your underwear? And the kid says, no. And I say, well, how do you get your legs through?
Good point.
Yeah.
Excellent point.
I said it to this one 14-year-old boy, and he pulled back his blanket, and he said, leg, because he was there, because he had osteosarcoma and just had his leg amputated.
Oh, my goodness.
So he was lying there with one leg, and the room went silent. So, of course, I took off my hat, I went over to his father, and I started hitting his father, going, what's wrong with you? You think my job is easy? I come into this room. There's no crutches. There's no wheelchair. There's no walker. Yeah, I have to come in. You couldn't tell me when I walked in. You couldn't give me a sign. So I turned to the boy and I said, is he like this all the time? And the kid in the bed goes, yes, he's like this all the time.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, what's wrong with you?
Right. So that's the new bit.
Yeah. I turned it into the reality that the parent was an idiot.
Right.
I said, both of them or just him? It's just him. You know, because he's a 14-year-old boy. He's going to turn on his dad. It's,
right.
And so, you know, I could have froze and been like, I'm a fucking asshole. What did I do?
Right, right.
You know, I shouldn't have said that. But I said it.
Right. It's in there.
And it was there. So, yeah, I had to play it. And that was my clown logic, was to turn on the parents. So.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So in 2008, that was the same year that you were a part of the PBS series called Circus.
Yes. I left working in the hospital program, and I auditioned and toured with the Big Apple Circus for a year. But I thought, yeah, if they shoot me, it'll be like cross-pollination, and I'll be helping out the hospital program, and I'll be helping out the camp hole-in-the-wall program by mentioning these things. And so they followed us for a year on the road, and they edited it down to 6 episodes, so 6 one-hour episodes. And I had no idea how I would be edited. I had no idea. Everywhere I went, there was a minimum of 4 people following me. And I also was coming out of a place in my life where I really never felt comfortable talking about myself or my problems. So when they asked me a question, I would answer it, oh, my wife says, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, you know, being on the road? Well, my wife says I'm fulfilling my childhood dream. I couldn't say I feel like this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. Meanwhile, I was having trouble with my peace in the circus, and they're thinking about firing me. I didn't know this until I saw the documentary later.
A lot of politics and
lots and lots of politics, of which I understood. You know, it's a small whatever, it was a community unto itself, a small traveling village with its own government. And it was a year of that,
wow.
Learning as I went. And
clown logic in real life.
In real life. And so it was a tough year. So when this documentary came out, I didn't know how it would be portrayed. I didn't know if I would be made a martyr or a whiner and all these things I don't want to be, mm-hmm. or be perceived as. I don't like talking bad about people behind their back.
Mm-hmm.
I was goaded into being
gossipy
and steered into answering questions that would incriminate me, and I didn't want to play. I didn't want to say, yeah, I'm jealous because they're doing this and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Or my time in the ring is cut back, but the other clowns isn't. I'm not...
Manufacturing conflict.
I'm not that kind of a guy. It was that type of stuff all season long. And I just... At parts, I wanted to scream. I would scream because people were ignoring me because my bit wasn't working. And other people were not, you know, oh, we don't want to be around him. He's the clown that his bit doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I just screamed. Somebody talk to me. Just pay attention to me. I didn't want to be invisible anymore. And it was so... And I didn't know how I would be edited in this documentary. And when it came out, I, without arrogance, want to say I was kind of an emotional center to it, where the audience is being led through the circus, through my eyes a little bit, because I'd never worked in a tent before. So it's like taking the audience along with me. Hey, I've never been in a tent. This is just, I'm like you. You've never worked in a tent. Come look at this. And it was the type of thing where I was on the cover of the DVD box, jumping over the word circus. And the opening credits, the word circus wraps around my head. And I still didn't realize I was the emotional center.
You're a sort of icon, mascot. There's so much about circus that we can see when watching you.
And I didn't get it when I saw it. I just saw, oh, God, I'm reliving this. Oh, Christ, that's right, that happened to me. Oh, hey, they wanted to fire me. Son of a bitch. It was that type of thing.
But if you watch this series, we still see so much of who you are, even though it's edited. There's so much of your humanity that took decades prior to refine, to hone in, and it shines through.
So you're saying I'm old?
No. This is a master clown in a way.
Wow. Thanks.
I'm saying it. I said it. But you've had so much experience of making a bit out of the next conflict.
Right.
You've built a career out of that.
Yes. In
a way. And you've been dealt so many conflicts and obstacles and managed to turn them into the next bit.
Yeah. It was lovely just having people approach me about that. And oh, my mother had Alzheimer's, and this mm-hmm. is how I approached that. Or I was homeless, and
mm-hmm.
this is what I learned from that. And thank you for mentioning depression and taking antidepressants. Mm-hmm. You were so open about that, because that's something I've hidden from my classroom, and I went down to Disney World, and somebody walked up to me and said, "You're that clown."
You're that clown.
I want to be like, but Mickey Mouse is right over there. But they wanted to talk to me. And it's really a beautiful thing.
Right.
I'm really appreciative of it.
So after 2008,
they went and did the editing, and I think it, I toured 2009, 2010, the documentary came out.
Right.
And then I was back to gigging, playing with silly bands.
You were in the Maestrosities.
In the Maestrosities. I was in Bathtub Jen.
Yes. At this point, we will reveal how I know Glenn. So in 2012, I met Glenn. We were a part of a vaudeville trio called Bathtub Jen and the Henchmen. Jennifer Harder is a performer who I knew from school who invited me to be a part of this trio, not knowing who the third was. And that was Glenn Heroy, who was going to be this Prohibition-era Keystone cop to my Russian gangster foil type character.
Yeah.
And in one of our first performances, we were dealing with switchblades and butterfly knives.
Because I had this great idea to do stage combat with real knives playing music.
While playing music. Right.
Because I thought it'd be funny to be strumming the ukulele with the knife, and then we would do this combat and stuff. And yeah, and at certain points I would lift Jen up while she was playing the trumpet.
Yeah.
And I'd carry her around, and it was very athletic and energetic. And
yeah, and we performed all over downtown.
Oh yeah, we hit a lot of the performance venues that people covet. Yeah. And in one of them, I believe I broke my finger.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't so bad that I couldn't just tape it up.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of insanity.
It was.
And you taught me about clown logic, and for that I am forever grateful.
Yay.
And it helped me understand how, and I think to summarize, how best to make a bit out of the unexpected, the contrary, any sort of conflict or obstacle is not to be ignored, but to be acknowledged. You can't deny it. The audience saw it. We're living it. This is the new bit. This is the next step. Not the thing that you were trying to get to.
Right.
And for that, I'm forever thankful. I think that's something that performers need to acknowledge throughout their careers, throughout their performances.
Yeah, and you taught me how to play the ukulele. And with my learning disability, it's was quite an inventive and ingenious way for that's you right. to teach me not only the ukulele, but how to speak with an Irish accent.
Right. You have to look at the shape of the chords. Yes. Sometimes they look like stairs, or sometimes the letter or the word that you sing when you play, it helps you remember.
Yeah. And so I would look at my fingering. We would change the name of the chords to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Charlie would sing the song that we were singing using the words I saw on my fingers.
It's somewhat like synesthesia in a way, because you think of it in pictures.
Yep.
You have an association while you're playing.
But I couldn't go home and do it now. I need to hear you sing the words. That's crazy.
I appreciate all that you've taught me to this point and look forward to what you can teach me, our listeners, anyone you come in contact with. You're such a resource, Glenn. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
It is my pleasure.
How do we reach you? GlennHeroy.com?
Yeah, I think there's a website there.
There's a website there?
Yeah, and all the pertinent information is there. I'm a horrible self-promoter.
You told me a joke. You know who called me a name dropper once?
Who?
Mick Jagger.
Oh.
Thank you again, Glenn.
My pleasure. Thank you, Charlie.